moving from there to London, where he studied at the London School of Economics with the great Karl Popper, whose ideas, I think it's safe to say, influenced and shaped your life. We all are having that experience at Amherst of great faculty who do so, and certainly Mr. Soros had that experience. When he came and settled in the United States, he began to work in the investment business. You may have heard about his success in that regard. It is, I think, safe to say that George Soros has been the most successful financial investor, perhaps in history.
No, well, it depends, because I would say Warren Buffett is recognized.
All right, never mind, Warren Buffett. We'll leave that alone.
different kind of investor.
But clearly someone who understood the need to analyze possibilities of investment and the importance of being willing to take risk in doing so, and having that work out rather well for him. And at the same time that Mr. Soros was becoming one of the great financial investors of all times, he was also becoming one of the great philanthropists of all times. Starting, I'm proud to say, or at least with some initial work in South Africa, where you don't know this, George, but one of your first grants was to the organization that I was working for, educational organization in South Africa, though you were there before me. Second. Right? I just talked to the director the other day who said you wrote him a check without him even asking.
Well, those are always the best checks.
George Soros today is responsible for something getting very close to $1 billion of philanthropy annually. That puts him, as far as I can tell, in the position of the second largest philanthropist in history.
I think again, I would say that Carnegie, it's a little unfair because it's not the same dollars.
It's not the same dollars, that's right. All right, there's Andrew Carnegie, whatever. And Mr. Soros is a triple threat, both as in terms of investments and philanthropy, but also as an author and thinker. He has rethought some of the basic assumptions of what the market means and therefore how economics works. His philosophical thoughts, guided again and to begin with by Karl Popper, on reflexivity, have challenged some of the basic assumptions of what a free market means and what rationality means in the free market. Taking into account personal reflection and lessons in a way that cold-hearted market theory does not fully account for. And I think the testament of his success suggests that that theory is right and certainly is working. He is the author of 11 books, most recently the Soros Lectures at the Central European University. You can find both the most recent book about his philanthropy here for sale afterwards, if you'd like, as well as a reissue of Masquerade, which is the book that his father wrote in Esperanto and was translated. So you don't have to read Esperanto to buy the book. It is Amherst's honor and privilege to have you here tonight. What we thought we'd do is relatively informal. I'll ask George to start with some reflections and some words, and then we're just going to open it up for questions and have a conversation with the audience.
Very good. Well, I thought I would sort of tell you where I come from and where I stand as a kind of warm-up to get you to ask whatever is on your mind. But you actually did a very good job in telling where I come from And actually, those two books also sort of deal with that, because the book of my father's, which is has been republished, is the story of 1944, which was the German occupation, where he saved his family and many other people by arranging for false identities. And that was, I would say, in retrospect, the formative experience of my life, because we were confronted by evil, very powerful evil, and we not only survived, but in a way overcame the triumph, because my triumphed because my father managed to help not only his own family, but many other people. And that kind of gave me a taste for confronting harsh reality. And instead of kidding yourself or allowing yourself to be deceived, which could be extremely dangerous for your health, to face the facts, however harsh they are, and then you may actually overcome them. Well, there are many other, there are many problems in life that actually are insoluble. But in trying to deal with them, and your unwillingness to face them makes those problems much worse than they would be otherwise. The number one problem, I think, is death, which is extremely difficult to, certainly you can't avoid it, but it's very difficult to come to terms with. And therefore, you find all kinds of ways to deal with it, which can be quite misleading. There are many other problems like that. And the particularly when it comes to seemingly insoluble problems, the misconceptions, I think, that that people develop to deal with them have a really dangerous potential of creating trouble for you. So also in my philanthropy, I seem to have sort of specialized in insoluble problems. And so I find myself now mainly engaged in countries in Africa and other parts of the world where it's extremely difficult, countries that have been destroyed by civil war, non-functioning states, foundations in countries like Haiti, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and most recently I became very involved in Guinea, which is an African country, very rich in natural resources, that has never seen democracy, as recently had military massacred people, and as a result there were elections, and somebody has been elected president who would like to change the culture of corruption, which is pervasive, and has turned to us for help. And I'm trying to actually help him, but I can tell you it's an extremely difficult thing to be of assistance in a country where the human resources are not there. And when I originally set up the foundation, and then in 1979, and first when started in South Africa, and then Eastern Europe, which was under communist rule, And I got very involved in the communist, in the collapse of the Soviet system. And then when that revolutionary period kind of calmed down and set up a foundation in America, actually the first two issues that we addressed was one, a project on death in America because of the denial of death that is, was part of the American culture, and the drug problem, which is again one of the insoluble problems in the sense that you can't have a drug-free America because there is a problem of addiction. But the way we deal with the drug problem has made it really much, much worse. And it's an issue in which I intend to get again very much involved because I think there's an opportunity now to change the drug laws for the first time in 20 years that I've been involved in the issue, mainly because of the financial crisis. And today, there are in California, which is in a financial crisis of the first order, California this year spends more money on the prison system than on the educational system. To me, that's a shocking fact, and I hope that that can be changed. I think that's actually, I'm just sort of talking. I can keep on talking, but maybe you want to ask people what they want to hear about.
All right, so here's your chance. What would you like to ask George Soros? I'm going to be sorry to have asked this question. All right, yes, sir, right there.
Hi, you've mentioned you have a lot of experiences with philanthropy. So I would assume that you've had many, many rewarding experiences during the work that you're doing. So I guess my question is, what is, I guess, the most rewarding experience that you felt? What is the most rewarding feelings that you felt? And how, and what was the work that led to that feeling?
What's the most rewarding part of being a philanthropist? What have you enjoyed the most? What have you felt the best about?
Well, generally speaking, I get the greatest satisfaction in visiting one of the foundations and discovering what they are doing that I don't know about. In other words, the unknown activities are the ones that give me the greatest sense of satisfaction, because the situations that I know about are tend to be problematic, and the unexpected is the most rewarding. And I must say that as I travel around and see, because we have a very, very unusual, in the sense of very distributed responsibilities, local foundations that decide their own priorities. It's very heartwarming to see what they are doing on their own.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Soros, thank you for coming. I'm wondering, you've been so involved in bringing and helping democracy establish itself in ex-communist areas such as Eastern Europe. I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on the outlook for democracy finally taking root in parts of the Arab world.
What are the prospects of democracy in the Middle East?
Well, that's a very exciting period now in the Middle East. It has great similarities to what happened in with the collapse of the Soviet system, because it is the collapse of a system, and a very spontaneous uprising even more, I would say, disorganized than at the time of the collapse of the Soviet empire. There are some big differences. First of all, that the regimes that are collapsing are our allies, and that's a big difference. I would say that actually we have been handling it quite remarkably well, considering that they were our regimes with which we had a long-standing relationship. And so I think, for instance, the administration, by persuading, first of all, by allowing the people to express themselves and not dictating to them or telling them what to do, so not interfering in that way. But I think to persuade the Egyptian army not to shoot on unarmed protesters was a great accomplishment, which allowed the revolution to remain peaceful. And I would say that Tunisian and the Egyptian revolutions are in fact still in a very hopeful state. In fact, to me, surprisingly so, because I didn't expect to have such a strong secular and sort of middle class led and youth led revolutionary force, as proved to be the case. However, when you have countries with sectarian and tribal divisions, which take precedence over sort of political sentiments, then revolution has a tendency to turn into civil war. And then it's a totally different situation, as manifested by Libya. And also, I think that I'm very disturbed about the way things worked out in Bahrain. I thought that the Arab revolution would actually sweep the Iranian regime eventually away. And then what happened in Bahrain changed that, because in Bahrain the ruling family being Sunni and the majority of people being Shia, the protesters were mainly Shia, naturally. And the United States actually intervened and stopped the killing of the protesters, and prevailed on the king to appoint his son, who was actually Western educated and a liberal person, to take charge. And but then the son, in beginning to negotiate or trying to find a peaceful arrangement, realized that he would have to get the prime minister, who had been ruling the country for a number of years and who happened to be his uncle, removed. The uncle then turned to Saudi Arabia, And then Saudi Arabia actually, and Bahrain, well, you have to recognize, is a protectorate of Saudi Arabia. They receive $1 billion a year subsidy from Saudi Arabia. So they called him, the son, to Riyadh, and kept him there for 3 days. Very much actually reminded me of the regent of Hungary, Horthy, being called to Berchtesgaden by Hitler, and persuaded him to keep the uncle and to accept the Saudi and other troops who occupied the country. And since then, there is very severe repression. And that, I'm afraid, has converted that revolutionary movement into a Sunni-Shia confrontation, and has given a new lease on life to the Iranian regime, because they now can be the protectors of the Shia against Sunni oppression. And that is, I think, is a very unfortunate turn of events. And it's also has pit the Saudi Arabia against the United States. You now have a breakdown in relations between Saudi Arabia and the United States, which is also very troubling.
So let me ask a follow-up question, if I may. So, George, you and your foundation played a pivotal role in the transformation of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, moving to democracy and to capitalism. So here we are at this moment in the Middle East, unexpected and wonderful and scary and all of those things. Help us think about, when you think about what difference you can make as a philanthropist at this particular uncertain moment, to take advantage of the opportunities and hopefully to avoid the pitfalls. Mm-hmm. How do you think about what difference philanthropy or your philanthropy can make at a moment of such promise and uncertainty?
Well, we can make a difference. I would kind of describe our brand of philanthropy as a political philanthropy, which is a rather unusual category. But we have to tread extremely carefully. First of all, this is a homegrown revolution, where it's merit in a way. It's strength, and therefore the only role that you can play is if they are looking for some advice or some support in something, in your judgment, the people who are asking for it are in fact meant to be moving towards, or mean to move towards, a more open society, then you can try to help them, empower them. That's the only thing you can do, but it is actually can be a very valuable thing, because very often you have a movement towards what I call democratic regime change, and then the people who are coming to power don't have the capacity to deal with the problems of that they have to confront, and that's when I think you can be of help, and that happens to be true in the Arab states. And it was true also, and that's how we got involved in countries like Liberia, for instance.
Have you ever gotten it wrong, George?
Unfortunately, quite often. it's because it's and whatever you do, you have to be aware that you may be wrong, then you have to change course. So, for instance, I mean, right now in Guinea, we're trying to help a newly elected president, but he has some rather outdated ideas. Actually, he's an old socialist, and some of the ideas he has are actually outdated and not applicable to the modern world, and therefore I have to say that I can't help you in that. Right. So that's what makes things difficult.
Jose. Sorry. Microphone's coming. Maybe. Thank you.
I've read about your support for President Obama in the 2008 election. I was wondering what your thoughts are on his accomplishments thus far and what kinds of things you'd like to see him do in the next year and a half or if he gets reelected in the next years to come.
So your support for Obama in 2008, what you're happy about, what you're disappointed about, and what you're planning to do in the next cycle.
Frankly, I have been disappointed with the Obama policies because I supported Obama because I felt that the United States was in the wrong direction and needed to change. I mean, the Bush administration had taken the country in the wrong direction and needed radical change. And while I was a great admirer of Hillary, I would say a greater admirer of Hillary than of Bill Clinton, still it would only take you back to the Clinton administration. I thought we needed to go further than that in changing course. And I thought that Obama would bring that discontinuity, which I thought was necessary. And in fact, he did. The mere fact that he was elected was a demonstration that this country can change course. And it was actually the finest moment of his presidency. I think that the problems that he's confronting are bigger than he or any other president would be, because the country has come off a 25-year spree of living beyond its means, and the mere fact that that came to an end with the financial crisis of 2008 meant that you couldn't just recover from that and take and continue to on the same course as before. So you needed radical change. And it's a very painful. It's a kind of mourning after a kind of experience. I'm not blaming him because he didn't eliminate unemployment and so on, because I don't think that any president would have been able to do that. But I am disappointed because, as I say, he, and I actually respect him in some ways for his ambition to do it, to be the great uniter, to overcome party differences, and lead the United States of America. Unfortunately, that takes two sides. And he didn't, for very good reasons, very understandable reasons, the Republicans had no incentive to play that role, and every incentive to try to make him fail, and so it was actually a politically unrewarding path. It so happens that actually losing control of the of Congress puts him in a much better position, and I think actually he may yet emerge as the leader of the United States of America, representing sort of finally occupying the center by moving very much to meet the pressures from the Republican side.
So we're taking the gloves off tonight. I assume everyone here signed the form that you're not videotaping this for YouTube, is that? All right. Yes. Go ahead. Yep.
So when you were young, you were denied many times the visa to England, but you persisted. And then when you tried to go to the London School of Economics, you failed two times before being admitted for the third time. And then when you ran the fund, you lost most of your brother's money, but you persisted to earn so much money later. And then when your philosophy fell, you opened the Open Society Institute. So my question is, how did you develop the courage and persistence to pursue all the activities that you believe in life?
So the questioner is raising some points from your past, suggesting you didn't get a visa to England right away, you didn't get into the London School of Economics right away, you overcame, you lost money before you made money, you overcame lots of, you know, challenges. I think that would be a nice way to put it. And the question is, how do you learn how to do that, to overcome those challenges? And the courage to do so. When things don't work, how do you find a way to keep going, right?
Is that fair?
I have no idea what the facts are about your admission to the London School of Economics.
No, I think you are correct. When I went to England in 1947, I went there practically without money. It was very difficult. And it was a tremendous come down also because I was rather full of myself, having lived through a very adventurous war experience. And in England, people didn't really care to hear about that. So it was a difficult period, and there have been other difficult periods since.
You've broken your leg as well, isn't
that right? Yeah, I did, and actually that turned out to be a boon in disguise, because that's what allowed me actually to finish my studies. Because then I got, first of all, that was the heyday of national health. The beginning of national health had excellent medical attention without having to pay for it. And afterwards, I got industrial injuries benefit, and actually paid for a year of my studies, so it had its upside, I would say that it really was that experience in 1944 that kind of gave me this sense that adversity can be overcome and you can face harsh realities and you come out ahead. And actually, certainly the financial markets, recognizing the problems, can be very rewarding in when you make your investment decisions. So I was also lucky to end up in a field where this attitude turned out to be very rewarding.
George, can you say a little bit more about the pivotal experience of growing up in what became Nazi-occupied Hungary, and the survival skills that you had to learn for yourself and for your family and helping your father in particular, helping others? Say a little bit more about what that did to you, what lessons...
Well, I mean, this is what I have been saying, that, I was very lucky to have the father I had, because he had lived through a similar experience in the First World War, where he got caught up in the Russian Revolution and lived through it in Siberia, and he came back a changed man. So that was his formative experience, which then enabled him to deal with this trial period, which then became my formative experience. And interestingly, it is a pivotal part of my conceptual framework, which guides me in dealing with these issues, because I let's say in my theory about financial markets, I distinguish between equilibrium conditions and far from equilibrium conditions, and I also in my political philanthropy make the same distinction about political developments. In other words, you have got normal times and abnormal times. And what I learned from my father is that in abnormal times, the normal rules don't apply. And unless you adjust to the changed circumstances, you may not survive. So that was a big, big lesson, which my father was not the only one who learned that. If there's another, a famous Hungarian by the name of Arthur Koestler. At least he was famous in those days. And he wrote his autobiography, Arrow in the Blue, where he said that his greatest accomplishment in life was actually to have survived as a Central European Jew in all those years. So that was the formative experience.
Oh boy. Yes, ma'am, there. No, right, you. Don't turn around. Yep. You, yes. No, not you. Right there.
So your philanthropy affects countries with impoverished economies.
You need to, even I can't hear you. You need to speak up.
Okay. So your philanthropy affects countries with dysfunctional states and impoverished economies. Would you say that your philanthropy works more on the level of creating a self-sustaining economies in which the citizens can and the people there can further their own development, or would you say it works more on the level of delivering immediate aid to citizens? And which type of philanthropy do you think works best?
So the question is, do you focus in your philanthropy on achieving self-sustaining development or assistance in a more sort of immediate way?
Yeah. No. You know, this is the thing about teaching people to fish, right? Rather than giving them fish to eat, and actually in Russia there's an island in the north where they have fantastic wooden buildings built in the 18th century without actually nails, and there was a school where the people were taught to restore these buildings, and then I joked. We actually supported that enterprise, and then. I was joking that we now have to teach them how to fish. So, but at any rate, generally speaking, we are trying to help people to help themselves, and that's really the purpose of the exercise.
You just had a Hungarian Jew cite the gospel to you: the carpentry and fishing. Yes, sir. Right? Yep. Go ahead. Go ahead and say it. I'll repeat it. Don't worry.
It seems like many times you'll hear about these pro-democracy, anti-government groups in countries with dictatorships who have very noble principles and then later on will turn out to do things that are maybe at best unsavory and at worst drastic human rights abuses. So I was wondering how you balance that risk when you're supporting these groups, or how you evaluate the risk that that's going to turn out happening.
No, you are right. Usually you have a repressive regime and the people who oppose it and then get elected become repressive rulers. I can think of, let's say, President Wade of Senegal, who was an opposition lawyer, human rights activist, then became president and totally changed his character, and he's not the only one. It just comes to mind, generally speaking, revolutions are an opportunity to build a more open society. But the building of a more open society takes a much longer time because it means building institutions. And if you fail to build the institutions either before or after a revolutionary change, then the revolution starts with euphoria and ends in tears. So I'm not actually a supporter of revolutions as such. I believe in more a gradual change. But sometimes when you have a repressive regime which doesn't allow a peaceful democratic development, then there is no alternative to a revolution. And that's when the difficulty is, and that's when the support is needed to help build those institutions.
So someone was asking me about South Africa recently, and actually it's rare to think of an instance where a revolution doesn't end up disappointing, right? I mean, you argue sometimes it's necessary for it to bring the change that has to be gotten past, and yet there does seem to be an all too familiar pattern in which it ends up disappointing, to put it mildly.
Actually, a study of civil strife by Paul Collier, who was actually, I think, one of the most brilliant analysts of development economics. He's shown that the largest single predictor of a future civil strife is civil strife in the past. In other words, once you get on that path, you're liable to repeat the cycle because you don't have the institutions that would allow peaceful development.
Though the open society notion is about how to create those institutions.
That's right. I mean, democracy is more than just elections, even free elections. It requires these institutions. And very often, having elections is an inducement for repression. I often wonder in cases, let's say, in Central Asia, where they do have elections, but they also have repressive regimes. And lo and behold, the repressive regimes win the elections. But the methods they use are repressive methods, and it means repressing free expression and cracking down. Maybe, you know, you could have a slower, if you had no elections, you would have a more peaceful path towards development of institutions, rule of law. Now, I know this is a politically incorrect thing to say, and I'm not advocating doing away with elections. But I'm just saying that actually elections, when you have a repressive regime, and particularly in countries which are depending on natural resources, where being in control is a very desirable prize, because it's an opportunity to benefit from those natural resources and to receive bribes getting rich.
You think an open society is more likely in a society that doesn't have natural resources?
Yeah, actually, let's say, taking the Africa, resource-rich countries are just as poor as resource-poor countries. But the resource-poor countries actually have more democratic governments. So let's say Mali has a more democratic government. Not a very great capacity, but nevertheless more democratic than, Angola, which is now a very prosperous country, but because it has natural resources that the president and the ruling party...
So wealth is a curse, George Soros?
Well, I mean, there's called the resource curse. It's called the resource curse. And actually, as a foundation, a network, we spend a lot of our efforts in fighting the resource curse. And it's probably in the last 15 years, no, last 8 years, it's been probably the area we have made the most tangible process. progress.
Say something about the program of giving transparency to where the resources are going.
It started off with a campaign, Publish What You Pay, which was launched in 2002, which fortunately was adopted by the Blair administration, and they sponsored the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which we supported, and we established the Revenue Watch Institutes, and that has actually made a lot of progress, and it's still going very strong.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I know the initiative, and actually Bill Gates has asked me to join. I wish him success, and I'm not opposed to it, but I didn't join it because I don't think it's a question of how much you give away, but how you give it away. So it's you can't measure success by the amount of money you give away, but
because you can give it away stupidly.
Correct, and that's why I'm not actually actively supporting it.
Let me just state for the record that Mr. Soros's record in terms of giving away percentages of his resources is probably unmatched, but. It is what you do with the resources. Yes, what's up? Go ahead. Yep.
Getting back.
I think you have.
No, sorry, it was in the back. Sorry, I apologize.
Yeah. I think you.
Go ahead.
A lot of people on both sides.
You said that you became an investor so that one day you could become a financially self-sufficient writer and philosopher. I have same interests: investing, philosophy, writing. And I was wondering, are you satisfied with your life path? Is there something you would have done differently? Perhaps a difference in timing or selection of activities?
Are you satisfied with your life, George?
actually, very, very, very much so. And strangely enough, the older I get, the more satisfied I am.
Well, Mr. Soros, we are honored to have you here, especially during such an historical time. I'm talking about yesterday's killing of bin Laden. I would like to know, there's been a real debate going on now of how effective that was and sort of where do we go from here? I would like your opinion, if you would weigh in on, do you think we're going to be any different now than we were, say, a day ago? Where should we go with regard to Afghanistan and Iraq? And also, we've seen a lot of young people sort of taking to the streets last night, waving flags and chanting USA. How appropriate do you think that is? Do you think that's good for America, bad for America?
No, I think it's a wonderful thing that finally he's been caught and it does... is a great accomplishment, I think, and it's something to rejoice about. And I think it will also change things quite a bit. But I don't think that he was actually running Al-Qaeda now. I think that he was actually, he must have, in my opinion, he was probably on dialysis and sick. And so he was, in any case, Al-Qaeda is a very, very non-hierarchical establishment, but very much diffuse. So it's not the end of Al-Qaeda, I don't think. But it is nevertheless a big defeat. And I think that it probably gives Obama a freer hand to deal with the problem of Afghanistan. Because the main reason for being in Afghanistan was to the threat of terrorism that could use Afghanistan as a base and threaten our security, our homeland security. And that, I think, has greatly diminished by the fact that he wasn't caught in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan. So I think it will have that open up that what we do in Afghanistan going forward. I think it will also have a far-reaching effect on our relationship with Pakistan, because clearly he could not have lived for 5 years in a mansion that was basically very close to the military security apparatus, and a very special kind of house. It was actually built to provide security for someone, and most likely for him, 5 years ago. So this could not have happened without some authority in Pakistan knowing about it and not talking about it. So it will bring our relationship with Pakistan, which is anyhow extremely fraught, to a new sort of a crisis point, I think.
Sir.
Yes, the United States is supposed to be an example to the world of a real democracy based on free and fair elections, one person, one vote. And yet, in the 2000 election, there's evidence to suggest that Bush didn't win the election, that more votes were cast for Gore in the state of Florida. Thousands of people thought they voted for somebody else and their votes were counted differently. And then 4 years later, in Ohio, 150,000 votes was the margin of victory for Bush, but 250,000 African-American votes in population centers were tossed out. So there again, there's evidence to suggest that Bush lost twice. Now, the fact that he got elected meant that we had a war in Iraq. Also, we have a Supreme Court, which is heavily tilted in a certain direction for decades. And Jimmy Carter, who worked in many other countries to try to make sure there were free and fair elections, said that he would only work in those countries if there were certain standards that were there first. But he said the United States didn't even have those kinds of standards. He couldn't even work in the United States, given the way things were in terms of trying to make sure there were free and fair elections. So my question is there any possibility that in this country we could actually have the electoral process remade so that there'd be a uniform standard of voting in all 50 states where you really could be sure that every vote did count, that if electronic voting machines were used, they couldn't be rigged, and that there'd just be no question about it anymore? I know it would take not only billions to revamp the system, but also each state would have to. It'd be quite a process, but could it ever be possible that we could do that?
Look, I think that our electoral system is clearly imperfect, and there are clearly deficiencies in it that could and should be corrected. But I don't see the political will to do it. So it's an imperfect. We have deficiencies. I recognize it, and I think that there are some improvements that could be made. There was an initiative to have, for instance, the president elected by popular vote, by getting more than half the states adopt a rule that the electors have to be guided by the popular vote for the United States, not for the in their own states. And if more than half the states adopted it, then effectively you could reform the electoral system in that way without constitutional amendment. So that, I think, is a very interesting proposition. I don't think it's making a lot of headway. And there are some other worthwhile electoral reform proposals, but as I say, they are not making a lot of progress.
Yes, sir.
So Amos is often telling us as a student, both implicitly and explicitly, that after graduation we should be out saving the world. And there are generally two sort of stated paths for that. One is, as you have done, become financially successful and give back to society at some point. The other is to dedicate your life to a cause and to live your life through that. If a young college graduate comes up to you and asks you, how do I navigate that choice? What would you tell them?
What does
for a young, almost college graduate, should one go out and make a fortune and use it wisely and judiciously to improve the world, or should one skip the fortune part and just find a way to improve the world by doing something other than philanthropy and investments? Is that a fair description? Yeah.
I think that's very much an individual choice.
If you're lucky.
You can do it either way.
Either way. All right. Professor Taubman.
Russia, let's say, and Eastern Europe, which programs do you think of yours worked and which didn't, and why not? Were there things you might have done but didn't, things you did do but shouldn't have?
It's extremely difficult. There's no general rule, and generally speaking, it's much harder to evaluate philanthropic success than business success, because in business you have a bottom line, and that bottom line it tells you exactly what you have accomplished. Whereas in philanthropy, you affect different people in different ways, and you can't really bring all those people down to a single denominator. So it's much harder. You don't have a single measure. And I think actually one of the fallacies in the most innovative philanthropy is the insistence on measurable results, quantifiable results. And that's not attainable. In my opinion. Now, then it becomes a matter of judgment. And you take, for instance, my involvement in the Soviet collapse. And I look at you look at Russia, and I spent, I would say, probably $1 billion on the foundation in Russia, or close to it. And you look at the result, and there's not much to show. Nevertheless, I feel that the money was not wasted at all. And sometime in the future, it will bring these results. Because in philanthropy, I think you have to the big difference between philanthropy and business. In business, you make an investment in order to make a profit. In philanthropy, I think you should stand for principles, win or lose. And I think that you can lose the battle, so to speak, and yet the mere fact that you have stood up for principles is the right thing to do, because it will leave a mark, and other people are going to be standing up for principles. So there's a man by the name of Sergei Kovalyov, who was ombudsman in the new Russian Duma, and actually settled the first Chechen war, brought peace before the second war then destroyed Chechnya. And he said, all my life I fought losing battles. And I think he came out ahead.
I actually think that answers your question as well. Yes, Ben. Go ahead. Yep.
The China's development model, but China is still facing many domestic problems and lacks sufficient democracy. So I would like to know that, in your opinion, how pivotal democracy is to the development of a nation.
How important is democracy for development, with particular reference to China, which seems to be developing without at least formal democracy?
Well, China is a very interesting case, because it's definitely not a democracy, but it's a much more open society than it used to be. And even though you, for instance, have no democracy, you actually have quite a bit of democracy within the party, which is a big, big difference between the Chinese Communist Party and the Russian Communist Party, which was a top-down dictatorship. It's really an open question which way China is going to develop. I'm hopeful that with material prosperity, there will also be an increasing demand for political freedom. And I know it is for a fact that many of the people in positions of power have been oppressed by a repressive party and state, and were, you know, lived through re-education in the countryside, and really value individual freedom very highly. But at the same time, I worry that when it comes to for rulers to reduce their power for the sake of the public good, there's a tendency to resist that. So it's a very open question, but a terribly important one. In fact, I would say perhaps it's the most important question for the future of mankind. How China is going to develop, whether it will move towards democracy or as the rulers feel threatened, they then impose or use more repressive measures. So it's really an open question.
So I'm going to press that open question. You have $1 billion to invest. You can choose either India or China.
Well, I don't think that that's the only consideration.
I'm making it up.
No, it's not the only consideration that comes into because actually you can make a very good investment even if China doesn't take that positive.
This is why you're better at what you do than I am.
Well, it's not as long as you sell in time. In other words, that question is going to remain open for a while, and so in the meantime, you can actually make money in China without it being. I think the fact that India is a democracy is very much a favor. Appointed its favor, and the fact that you have the rule of law is also very much in its favor. But at the same time, India has a security problem, and when it comes to dealing with security, India is not such an open society. I mean, the security forces have considerable leeway. So it's a mix. It's a mixed picture.
Oh, sorry. So playing off your last question, do you ever have any fear or apprehension about supporting democratic or capitalist regimes, insofar as that they often create the veneer of a just or equitable society? Where socioeconomic mobility is perceived to be a truth, but often they mask injustices, as we're seeing with the disparity of wealth within our own country, or the fact that 85% of people in our country don't actually change their socioeconomic class from where they're born into. So do you ever have any fear about supporting these types of regimes insofar as that can create kind of this perception of justice that can actually mask certain atrocities taking place?
So Isaac's question is, given economic inequalities in America and the way in which mobility is not happening, does that make you worry about assuming the values of democracy and of supporting programs in the United States when we seem to be masking, or countries like the United States are able to mask the true inequality of our system and the lack of mobility within it?
No, frankly, I am very, very concerned about the future of open society in the United States. I think open society is endangered in the United States, has been endangered and remains endangered. And I spend a lot of time thinking about what is causing that and what can one do about it. I'm concerned about the decline of democratic discourse. I'm very concerned about a corporate capture of the state, the corporate capture of academia. The fact that, you know, the concept of open society as it was expounded by a Popper made actually a false assumption, which to some extent came from his study of science, namely that he thought that free discussion, freedom of speech, leads to a better understanding of reality and better policies. That basically political discourse is directed at finding better policies. And that is actually happens to be untrue, because political discourse is about winning elections without necessarily paying any attention to the truth. So the lack of commitment to the pursuit of truth, which I think is now deeply ingrained in our culture, and is the characteristic of the electorate. In other words, I hold the electorate responsible for the excesses of our politicians. But
Donald Trump is our fault?
I think you know, we want to be amused, and so he has certain entertainment value. It's actually something that I'm really very, very preoccupied with, and I don't fully understand the problem, what it is that's causing the problem. But I'm very, very conscious of institutions that have worked for 200 years not working well anymore.
Yes.
Just curious, do you think that growing up with Esperanto changed your worldview at all? And I'm also curious as to whether you still get
worldview.
Do you still get to use it ever?
Well, it certainly influenced it because my father was an Esperantist and I admired my father. Esperanto was a beautiful idea. What I call a fertile fallacy. It has been superseded by bad English.
as the universal language. Yes, in the back, go ahead. Just shout it out, I'll repeat it, don't worry. Thank you.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah.
So the question is, if I can summarize, I think, is the crucial problem that we were living beyond our means, or that some people were living better than others, and that inequality, financial sector, et cetera, sort of dug us into this hole? I mean, is it which of those is it?
No, I think you're putting your finger on the right in the right place, because the you see there is now a dominant belief or doctrine which I call market fundamentalism, which holds that with markets, with the, due to the invisible hand that allocates resources, people pursuing their self-interest actually bring about the best allocation of resources, the optimum allocation of resources. And that, I think, is a false idea, and it's a very appealing idea for those who are in control of the resources, because the idea that you can actually be an upright citizen while you're just concentrating on making as much money as possible is a very, very gratifying belief, if only if it were true. But because it's so appealing, and because it also serves the self-interest of those who have the means to support and foster that idea, that's how that idea has become the dominant misconception in the United States in recent years. And that resulted in, I go back to, let's say, 1980 with the presidency of Reagan, where market fundamentalism became the dominant idea in the United States, and Margaret Thatcher was prime minister in England. So that's when the globalization of and deregulation of financial markets started. And that was also the beginning of what I call the super bubble, where reducing taxes, enabling people to make money, liberating competition, allowed the differential to widen in favor of the haves. And nevertheless, the middle class was enabled to maintain its spending, its living standard, through borrowing, increasing borrowing because of the housing bubble that developed after 2000. So you covered up the widening distribution of income by piling on debt, which at first was substantiated by the appreciation of property, of houses, and then eventually that bubble burst in 2008, and you now have an extremely difficult adjustment process, which has hardly begun. I mean, there's been some increase in savings rate, but of course that is what leads to increased unemployment. And so this is the difficulty that we currently face.
We're gonna do two more. Yes, ma'am. Sorry, go ahead, yep. Yep.
So you've thrown your support behind the progressive Jewish American political organization, J Street. And I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on the Israel-Palestine...
Say the name of the organization again.
J Street. And I was hoping you could share your thoughts on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and in particular, the role that organizations like J Street play in shaping U.S. engagement in the conflict.
So your support for J Street and your views as to the resolution of the Palestine-Israel conflict, and what difference you think you can make in that?
Well, I do support J Street, but not to any great extent, because I haven't been, I didn't earn my spurs as a supporter of Israel that I would consider myself particularly qualified to be a critic of current policies pursued by Israel. So I take a somewhat distant position with regard to Palestine.
Yes.
Bouncing back on the financial bubble, first, I would like to thank you, and I'm honored to meet you. Your foundation have funded the NGO I co-chair at the border of Hungary and Romania last year, allowing street children to slowly get involved in a reintegration process. But about precisely the philanthropy you've been accomplishing, what I know is the situation of the street children, and we realize that when we trace back the reasons of their expansion more and more, even though Romania is in the European Union today, we can trace back this conclusion to the financial bubble and some maybe irresponsible behaviors of some financial actors. My question is, in the holistic activity of philanthropy, do you think that it starts with maybe sensitizing your peers? And if so, how?
Sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question. Sensitizing your peers, meaning peers as philanthropists, or right. Your any of our peers?
Financial actors.
So how much of the impact you can have is not just your own work, but the impact you can have on getting other people with resources to think similarly, spend, invest, et cetera. Is that fair?
Well, that I think depends on the other people. I do what I do. I don't preach to other people that they should be philanthropists. But I think I certainly run into people who say that they are on the same wavelength and they also want to do more or less the same things, and we work together on a number of issues.
So let's just take a moment to be grateful for George for your being here. People disagree or agree with your politics, but I don't think anyone can question, and I think as you've demonstrated again tonight, the sort of amazing reach of your wisdom, of your engagement in issues, of your willingness to be honest about those, and to think hard about how to use your intellectual and financial resources to improve the world. And going back to a question that we got to earlier on of sort of how do you think about that, which students at Amherst think about all the time, you are clearly an inspiration to multiple generations. And for that, we say thank you. Standing for you.